From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll discuss a recent report by the Annie E. Casey Foundation that finds Wisconsin is the worst state in the union for black children. Then, you want to buy a mall? The shops of Grand Avenue are up for auction. The starting bid is $4.75 million. Why a newcomer to Milwaukee who isn't an architect is captivated by the architecture here.
What has always fascinated me since I've moved here is how all of these old buildings across the city are in use. Back home during the oil boom, it left so many buildings afterward without a use.
And the joys of conducting the Master Singers of Milwaukee.
There's a lot of incredible dedication, a lot of talent, incredible amount of talent, and a lot of experience. So it's been a privilege for me to be working with them, sharing music with the community.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. A recent report named Wisconsin as the worst state for the welfare of black children. The Annie E. Casey Foundation study, called Race of Results, Building a Path to Opportunity for All Children, ranked states according to 12 indicators that measured the well-being of children of all races across the country. While Wisconsin ranked 11th for white children, it came in last for African-American youth. Though this particular finding was widely reported, UWM professor David Pate says there's a lot more to unpack in last month's report. So in our regular Real Talk with David Pate segment, we're going to look at the study's wider implications for children across the country and for other minority groups here in Wisconsin. Pate tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce more about what was measured.
What this study was doing is that Annie E. Casey has been known for the last 25 years looking at the well-being of children nationally. What this report did that was different was it looked at what are the 12 indicators of success for children of color, being that we're going to be soon a nation of children of color and also a workforce of children of color in 2030. They thought it was important to start looking at a way for us to start planning how to deal with this change in our demographics and demography of who we are.
And of course, to begin that, we need to know where we stand.
Where do we stand, exactly?
So, in fact, what did the study show across the nation?
You know, it was interesting what the study showed across the nation because one thing it showed that, unfortunately, Wisconsin was the worst for African-American children in America in terms of the indicators that they presented. But also it showed that as a nation, we're not doing great across race for anyone, to be honest. I mean, of course, those who are white still maintain a place of good strength and well-being, but Asians are the ones who are coming out on top. If you looked at the numbers there, they also showed that there's a number of things that we could do in this study. And they also, for the first time, which is really unique, has presented information on American Indians. No one has really ever done that. And they were able to get 33 states to cooperatively give good information about how American Indians stand in our country.
Which were some of the indicators that you felt really surprised you in terms of how children of all races are doing?
Well, that's a really good place to start, too, Stephanie, because the one indicator, and I remember this with my own son, who has a slight, learning issue, making sure he could read at the fourth grade reading level. And if he wasn't there, to make sure that we ensure through extra help that he got there rather quickly. That's the one clear indicator of success in the future. And what we found for those reading at the fourth grade reading level, only 14% of blacks in this country are at that level. That's looking at them as adults. For Latinos, it's 19%. For American Indians, it's 22%. And for whites, it's 45%. And for Asians, it's 51%. So if we look at that on the other side, though, there's still 49% of Asians who are not reading there. And if you look at it for whites, it's 55%. So, you can all do the subtraction. But it's just interesting to say that of the indicators that is one of the clearest indication of success is your reading, is your ability to read. That's where we are not doing well as a country. And blacks are by far doing the worst in terms of their ability to read at a fourth grade reading level.
Now, the headlines here in Wisconsin obviously focused on the fact that Wisconsin ranked last among the reporting states for these various 12 indicators for the well-being of black children. What else did it show about the state of children in Wisconsin?
Well, we are pretty high up there in terms of the index being 1,000 being the perfect number. We come in 500, which is pretty good. We're right in the middle. We do very well. But also across the state, we're pretty good overall in terms of for whites across the country, we're number 11. For American Indians, we're number 12 out of 33 who provided data. For Latinos, we're number 17. So we're not doing that bad. But, of course, some of these indicators are not going to be a surprise to many of our audience listeners, but also to many people who do this work as a researcher. One, babies born at a normal birth rate. We're not doing well. As you know, Milwaukee has a major initiative to look at infant mortality. And so that was one of the indicators. And so, therefore, we've done very bad around live births as well as around children living up to their first year. The fourth grade reading level we've already talked about. Eighth graders who scored at or in proficiency in their math level, we're not doing well there. In terms of high school graduation rates, unfortunately for many black males, it's very low, in the 30%, but also for white males, it's not very good in Milwaukee. One of the other indicators is children who live in two-parent families. That's unfortunately not one of the indicators that's very strong for black children as well. So if you look at across all these 12 indicators, and I mentioned at least five of them just now, we have a lot of work to do around how do we make this so that these children have more resources and more access to wealth that's going to allow them to be able to have better outcomes for the state.
I wonder if part of the reason why this ranking has really struck home in Wisconsin is because of the fact that it is predominantly white, and then to have a minority group like black children rank so poorly. I mean, what does that indicate? What is that telling us about where we're putting our priorities and for whom?
Well, you know, it's such a complex and challenging answer. You know, Wisconsin is 88% white. We have 6% black in the whole state. However, our outcomes are just bad. We've been slammed a lot this year. One, we have the highest incarceration rate, as we've been talking about, for black males. And we also have the worst outcomes for black children in the country. Something is going on here that we need to closely examine. There have been several people who have talked about this issue of black children, from James Causey's provocative article that was in the Milwaukee Sentinel Journal in April that said, do we really care about Milwaukee kids, to the articles that I've seen in Madison. And I think that what everyone is saying, there hasn't been enough outcry or challenge to why aren't we doing better? I mean, this doesn't make any sense when we have one of the highest graduation rates in the country. At least 90% of students graduate in this state. However, for black kids, we're not seeing that. For Latino kids, we're not seeing that. Is it because they don't work hard enough, or is it because they don't have the resources that is required for them to be successful in school?
We also earlier this year did an interview with Erica Nelson from the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families about the Race to Equity report, which kind of echoed a lot of these Annie E. Casey Foundation findings.
Yeah, and what they found in that report was specific to Dane County was that the poverty is so disparate. I mean, you look at the number of if you look at the rate or the percentage of those who are in poverty in Dane County, for black kids, it's over 75%, and for white kids, it's under 10% or closer to 6%. So again, when you have that much poverty for a particular population, it indicates a lot of things are not going right. You know, there's not a lot of access to income. There's not a lot of access to wealth. There's not a lot of access to home ownership. So it makes things a little bit more difficult for you to be able to maintain your ability to succeed in school, to succeed in life, because you're just not exposed to all the same things that your counterpart has that makes their life a little bit better and a little bit easier.
Another surprising element of this report is that Wisconsin ranked 37th for children who are Asian or Pacific Islander. Why is that? I mean, what's going on there?
You know, the one thing about this population, this group of people, is that, again, there's a lot of subgroups of those who fall under this category, from Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Korean, Hmong. And to be honest, I'm really impressed that we are that high, because we have a large Hmong population, and the Hmongs generally don't do as well. We generally collapse all Asians into one group, and we tend to think of them as all doing very well. But Hmongs have been the population of people who have had to struggle and have had some challenges in trying to do well. Again, the Asian population already had a very high number. The highest number for them was 914. We came in at 656. Which is not that bad, but still, it's pretty good for the population of people that we have that are primarily Hmong population.
The study identified several reasons for why certain groups of children might not be doing as well as other groups. But what do you see going on here, David? I mean, I think we've talked about a lot of these issues before, but when you look at these specific indicators, what's going on when it comes to black children here? What's going on when it comes to Hmong children here?
I think the one thing that this report does that is really good, and I really would recommend those who are interested in looking into this further, read the report. they do a really good historical analysis of where people come from in terms of coming to America. You have certain things that you're guaranteed to as a citizen. For certain people, such as blacks and for Hmongs, those always weren't guarantees. Or for Latinos, they were always wanting a guarantee. For example, access to an FHA loan or through the GI Bill was not a guarantee for everybody. But also unresourced schools. Some schools that kids go to, they don't have the right books. They don't have access to a computer or a laptop. They don't have access to paper and pencil, to be honest. Poor neighborhoods cause for a community effect on people's lives. So things that you just would think and take for granted, for example, things that you would take for granted, those things are not always available to people that we're seeing. And those are what the report highlights. And it's one of the first reports that really gives a historical analysis that you just don't see in many reports. And also this whole idea of putting it in the context of a structural analysis versus it being a behavioral analysis, saying that because you don't study hard enough, because you don't work hard enough. And what this report says is that despite working hard enough and studying hard enough, you still may not get those resources. So I think that's why this report is really good. And also, I would want people to really think about, in order for us to move forward, we have to know where we're at. You know, and it really applies here. When we're about to have a workforce in 2030 that's going to be predominantly people of color, if they're not prepared to take our country in a place where we are or to maintain where we are, that's not good for any of us. So I think it's important for us to understand that we need to have better schools. We need to have better housing. We need to have better access to wealth and resources that are going to make everybody better off. Because, again, as I've said in previous shows, as a community, we all want to profit from everybody doing well. And when one of us does poorly or a number of us does poorly, nobody's going to do good at all.
I'm just going to harken back to the title of our segment here, though. Real talk, David.
Yeah.
We've known that things haven't been good for black kids in
exactly.
this state for
exactly.
a while. So why do you think there's maybe this outcry now when we get a report like this that pretty much tells us what we already knew?
But I don't know, Stephanie. The outcry has not been from people who are the majority in Wisconsin. I have not heard our mayor. I haven't heard our governor. I haven't heard some people on my faculty even say this is horrible. Of course, if I bring it up, everyone will recognize it as not being a good thing. But the paper, the op-ed pieces have been by people of color. The news reporting that I've seen have been by people of color. And I don't know whether or not we all understand that it affects us. Of course, I'm going to be a little more upset because when I hear black children are affected, I have a black child, so it makes me nervous for my grandchildren, for my nieces, for my nephews, and all of them. But I haven't heard enough of an outcry from those who don't look like those who are doing the worst in the state. And I think that's part of the problem. We haven't taken ownership of saying we all are in this together and we need to really make a difference in that way. Because I think all of us are saying we want something to happen. We know the problems. They're only getting worse, but we need to make a difference. But I haven't heard enough on TV programs or anywhere where this has made major news.
So really what I hear you saying, David, is we don't yet have that public and maybe political will to really address these issues.
This should be a wake-up call to us because what state wants to be known as the state that has the worst outcomes for any group of children? We always are saying children are the people that we really want to invest in and we want to put our money into, we need to have that wake-up call. And I think that this issue of consistent and caring adults in the children's lives is a big deal. You know, we keep focusing on two-parent families, but, you know, I know raising my own kids, I have 5, 6, 7 people taking care of my kids at any given time, from the basketball coach to the after-school person to my neighbor who picked up my kids because I couldn't get home from work in time or my wife was out of town. I think that we need to figure out how do we really take that to heart. Also, the whole idea that we need to know what works and we need to apply it. And really make sense of that. We've had a number of good programs in Milwaukee, for example, that were here and now are defunded but have shown that it worked. From a pass-through for child support that was making it better for families to a number of federal initiatives that were here. Also, we need to identify what is not working and then really making sure we have a conversation that is involving all the key stakeholders to be sure that we may take hold of that. So I think there's a lot of things we can do from, again, early childhood education to universal high-quality pre-K and kindergarten. There's a number of studies that show once if you do things for kids early on, it makes a major difference for how those kids are going to turn out in the end. So I guess not just providing child care, but make sure it's quality child care and quality services and quality education for these kids. So I would like to stop there, because I think that some of this is a repeat of what I've said before, but I really do think I want to emphasize that we really need to work on making sure that we work with kids in the early stage. But if I want to make sure I remind people that when you work with their kids, you need to work with those adults as well, because if those kids go home to parents who, again, are poorly educated or need resources, it's not going to help the kid in the end. It's only going to make a revolving door of problems and challenges in the future.
You talked about the idea of let's look at what's worked. I wonder if this study isn't a way for states maybe that ranked lower to look at what's going on in some of the higher ranking states and apply some of the strategies they're using there.
I totally agree with you. There's a number of states that are doing some good work, and I think that's why they're ranked so high, because they are doing some really good things. And we should look at what those states are and figure out what areas do we want to challenge and just slice out a small part of it. We can't make it all happen overnight, and it's going to take a number of years to change this, because it took a number of years to get here. But we need to figure out what slice do we want to take and cut that and make sure we do a very aggressive and assertive way of attacking it.
Until that happens, until we do get the groundswell of people really concerned about this, what can we really do? I mean, what's the first step that this state needs to do to improve the well-being of Black children?
Well, this even goes to the show we did last month on looking at Department of Corrections and wanting to have access to data. Here's some data. People should look at it, analyze it, figure out what can they do in their community, what can they do with their congressperson, what can they do with their local alderperson to see where it could be better in their community, and say this is not good for us. They need to also figure out how they can target investment and resources. I think that's the job of our mayor, of our governor, of those in Congress. How can you target resources to a community such as a Milwaukee, such as a Madison, such as a Conemaugh, I mean, such as a Lac des Flambeaux? I think they all need resources to have better outcomes. I think also we need to look at approaches that have proven to work in other states. If we haven't done it here, maybe we should think about trying some innovative ideas and getting those resources to do that. And also, we need to integrate economic inclusion strategies. When we don't see a group that's being represented on our workforces or in our programs, why is that? Why aren't they there? And what we should be figuring out a way to include them in those economic strategies to make sure that we all are better off in the end.
Well, David Pate, thanks so much for coming in and giving us this analysis of the NEKC Foundation report.
Thank you again for inviting me.
David Pate is our Real Talk contributor, as well as an associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. He's also the founder of the Center for Family Policy and Practice, and he spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Our Project Milwaukee series on the incarceration of Black men in Milwaukee has told the stories of many people who've been in and out of jail and prison for decades. Some of them served their first terms behind bars when they were children. Lake Effect essayist Paul Hines believes the cycle of imprisonment ought not to start so early.
Newsflash. A child is not an adult. Even if we ignore recent research that concludes brain development continues well into our 20s, there's a long-held belief that teenage brains are still developing through adolescence. So why is it that when a crime is committed, particularly a horrifically violent crime, district attorneys seem hell-bent on charging children as adults? Alex Reibel, the 16-year-old knife-wielding student who attacked classmates and a security guard in Pennsylvania last month, has been charged as an adult with 4 counts of attempted murder and 21 counts of aggravated assault. But a 16-year-old is not an adult. We don't yet live in some Orwellian world in which 2 plus 2 equals 5. Simply calling a child an adult does not suddenly transform a 16-year-old into a 36-year-old. This propensity to charge violent teens as adults is presumably to ensure that the perpetrators don't get off too easy, the way they might in a juvenile court. Sometimes this gets taken to extremes that most would find preposterous. In 2011, a 12-year-old in Florida was charged as an adult for murder. A plea deal was reached last year, so sanity ultimately prevailed on that one. But if the concern is that juvenile courts are too lenient on violent offenders, then it would seem that juvenile courts need to change. But prosecutors take the easy way out by, in effect, changing the definition of an adult. But if a 16-year-old truly has the faculties of, say, a 36-year-old, then you can't change the definition simply to suit your own needs. You have to go all the way. A 16-year-old should then be able to smoke, drink, defend his country, vote, create contracts, live independently of parental control, sue, make a will, and participate as a juror. Would you like to stand trial before a jury of 12 16-year-olds? I didn't think so. Perhaps then we shouldn't be so quick to raise the ante by zealously charging a child whose brain is still wiring itself. Sure, it could be argued that the age that defines adulthood is somewhat arbitrary, and that some leeway should be given to prosecutors. But that's not how the courts work in any other circumstance. One cannot stand before a judge and argue that he should be allowed to smoke as a 16-year-old because he's more mature than his peers. If the goal is to ensure that a lengthy sentence be achieved, then why stop at charging Alex Rybel as an adult? Why not charge him as a black man? That ought to put him away for a while. According to one study, black men serve jail sentences that are 20% longer than white men for the same crime. But black is not white, adults are not children. 2 plus 2 does not equal 5.
Paul Heinz is a writer, musician, and former Wisconsinite who now lives in the Chicago area. The Grand Avenue Mall is up for auction this week. We'll get the details from the Milwaukee Business Journal when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee's long-declining downtown shopping mall is again on the block. The Shops of Grand Avenue along Wisconsin Avenue between Plankinton and 4th Street has been bought and sold twice in the last decade. Owners have periodically tried to inject new life into the mall, which thrived a quarter century ago. But those efforts have only had mixed success, and the property was listed for auction this week. Stacey Vogel Davis is associate editor at the Milwaukee Business Journal and has covered the saga of the Grand Avenue Mall. She talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich about the latest developments.
Just kind of showed up on this auction website on Tuesday afternoon, auctions.com, which is a legitimate real estate auction site. And the auction will be taking place June 17th to the 19th. So it looks like the owner, which is a Bank of America Commercial Mortgage Trust, is looking to offload the property. And I'm told they're looking to offload a lot of their properties that they acquired through foreclosure. So they're doing a bunch of big deals here. And the minimum bid is $4.75 million.
Which, it should be noted, is less than they paid for it at Sheriff's Auction just a couple years ago.
Right. They paid $8.5 million in fall 2012 at Sheriff's Auction. But they were also the mortgage holder. So this project has cost them significantly more than that. And if you go back to 2005, which is when Northwestern Mutual first sold the property, that buyer paid $31 million. So its fortunes have fallen quite a bit.
Well, and so then let's talk about the checkered history of the mall. The mall has been there for more than a quarter century. It obviously had its heyday. How long has it been in decline?
A while. It's probably been about 2 decades since it hit its peak. I mean, the mall opened in 1982, and it was successful for, you know, the first decade or so. It had a lot of national tenants, you know, plenty of anchors, and it was a destination. People were coming downtown and shopping. It was definitely a Christmas shopping destination and that kind of thing. A lot of people remember the bear that was on the unicycle. But it started losing national tenants. It's downtown, and that's not the trend. Or it hasn't been the trend to have, especially these national retailers downtown. People are shopping in the suburbs where they live. So that's where a lot of the really successful malls have been, Mayfair and Bayshore. So, you know, Grand Avenue started to go downhill. It lost Marshall Fields in the mid-90s. That was a big blow. And it's just continued to lose these national tenants, and it really has accelerated in the last decade.
There have been periodic attempts to kind of inject new life or do innovative things with the mall. What have some of those things been, and how successful have they been?
Yeah, in the early 2000s, they did a major remodeling. That's when they brought TJ Maxx in, and also Linens and Things, which is no longer there. And that's when they kind of blocked off the stairways in the Plankinton building and put store space there. You know, they've tried to do other things where they brought in non-retail uses into the Plankinton building. This was a couple of years ago. That building was almost empty except for the TJ Maxx. So they brought in some business startups, creative groups, and that initiative is still going on. It's not really being marketed anymore, but they are still bringing in some new groups for that. They're bringing in some local retailers. You know, in June, there's a few more tenants that are going to open.
And these tenants are in there on much shorter term leases than malls traditionally do.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have a lot of details about some of the lease deals, but a lot of them have been a year or less, even as short as 3 months. We know they're not paying the kind of rent that a national tenant would. So it's kind of unclear, you know, if they're even paying enough to keep the mall afloat. And a lot of these retailers, it's their first store or their local shopkeepers. And so the stores don't always make it. And that kind of creates some turmoil in the shops coming and going. And it hasn't really succeeded in attracting a whole lot of new shoppers. It's not necessarily what shoppers are looking for.
What kind of effort did Bank of America put into the shops at Grand Avenue in the 2 years or so that it's had it?
Well, they were very quiet. I mean, I don't think they ever gave a statement to the press or anything like that. But when we talked to the broker they hired, Mid-America, they had said they were looking to bring in national retailers again, kind of going back to the mall's heyday. So they did make some marketing efforts in that area. They were able to re-sign some tenants, so that was a victory. And they did continue to bring in some of these smaller local tenants. They weren't really successful in bringing in any major new national tenants. But they also did do some infrastructure work. According to the mall manager, the owner has spent millions on upgrading the parking garage, some new lighting, and you know, they're planning to work on a heating and air conditioning project. I don't know how this new auction news is going to affect that project.
There have been discussions that one of the things that is handcuffing the mall is its lack of accessibility to the street. Is that likely to hamstring anyone who might be interested in bidding on this property?
Well, actually, I mean, what the city has been saying is that that is a possibility that the mall could be opened up to the street. So it's possible that a buyer could come in and say, we are going to open up these stores or whatever ends up going in the building to the street. It's really more a choice of the owner and how much they want to spend and whether that's something that they're looking to do.
How wrapped up would you say the shops of Grand Avenue is in the issue of A, the downtown arena debate, and B, what will happen to that essentially vacant lot that is a parking garage next to it's across the street from the Boston store and by the downtown Hilton?
Yeah, I mean, the Grand Avenue is vital to everything that goes on downtown. It's right in the heart of downtown, and it's, you know, the major shopping district when it comes to downtown proper. If you're not looking at the Third Ward or some of these other neighborhoods, it's right across the street from the convention center. So, you know, people come in for these shows and they're looking for a place to shop, and what they have is the shops of Grand Avenue, which really is not what these travelers are looking for. So, you know, having a vital new use there would really be a boost for anything going on downtown. And at the same time, those efforts could affect who chooses to buy Grand Avenue and what they choose to do with it. So if there's a new use at the lot on 4th and Wisconsin, you know, that'll obviously have an effect on what happens with Grand Avenue. And if we have a brand new sports arena that's attracting a lot of people, that could bring in new retail or any kind of other kind of new uses to Grand Avenue.
We should mention, we've talked about the future of the Boston store a couple of times in the past. The Boston store is actually not part of this property, correct?
Right. The Boston store is separately owned, and now the city has approved millions in financial assistance to Boston store to help that store stay open through January 2018 and also to keep the Bon-Ton corporate offices there, and Bon-Ton is Boston store's parent company. So, you know, hopefully that'll be an incentive to help sell the Grand Avenue property, knowing that that Boston store will be there at least for the next few years. And this also does not include the upper floors of the Grand Avenue building. So we've got the YMCA and the UWM School of Continuing Education. Those are not part of this property.
Well, to be continued. Stacey Vogel-Davis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stacey Vogel-Davis is associate editor at the Milwaukee Business Journal and is covering the story of the shops of Grand Avenue, which was listed for auction this week. She spoke with Mitch Teich. Other structures in the city have had far better luck than the mall. Coming up next, a newcomer to Milwaukee digs into the history of many of our unique buildings. We'll find out more when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North, and it is great to have your company. Amy Robinson isn't a historian. She's not an architect, and she's not a Milwaukee native. So at first blush, she might not seem like the natural person to write a column on distinctive historic Milwaukee buildings. But those factors actually play to Robinson's advantage in her blog, which appears at Milwaukee Magazine's website. The feature is called Intersections, and Robinson, who is an editorial assistant at the magazine, will join us from time to time in the days to come to talk about some of what she learns about these buildings. But first, she spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about what spurred her interest in Milwaukee's buildings.
I'm from a small town south of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and what has always fascinated me since I've moved here is how all of these old buildings across the city are in use. It's something that I find absolutely amazing because back home during the oil boom, it left so many buildings afterward without a use. There are several as you're going down the street that are empty and there are no businesses to fill them. And it's something that I just find really great to see here. They're all occupied and kept up in great shape.
Do you feel that people back home didn't necessarily have the same attachment to the old as we apparently do here?
I almost think so. I think that whether it's something that the oil boom came so quickly and there just wasn't this great attachment to these buildings as we might have here, or is it the fact that maybe newer is better? Is there just a different mindset between the different cultures?
Well, and I wonder if also you bring sort of an untainted eye, whether you think as you've explored that you see some things that people who might drive down the street and see the same buildings every day might not, just because we've been driving past them for 4 or 5 or 10 or 30 years.
Well, and that definitely could be. I know there's one blog that we published. It's been just a few weeks ago about this leaning building on Water Street. And it's something I drive by this building 4 times a day. Don't ask how much I spend in gas per day. It's ridiculous. And it's something I look at this building and it's leaning. It's apparent. And I wonder, what is wrong with this building? There are people going in and out and it's still in use. And it's really a pretty neat bar. But to look at this building and just think, what is that? What did it used to be? And why is it this way today? And to go inside is just, it's just something. It just really tells a story.
You are not a historian. You are not an architect. So what is it that you hope to do as neither of those things by exploring these buildings?
I hope to just bring an awareness. And I think that it takes almost an outsider's view to do that. I know plenty of people who aren't from Oklahoma who tell me all these amazing things about my state or the best place to get fried chicken that I had no idea about. I think it takes an outsider's view walking past a random building to ask why or what did this used to be? And just to ask all of these silly questions, because maybe it gives me a right to do so just because I am an outsider looking in.
Well, and how are you telling these stories? What is a typical entry in the Intersections blog look like?
You know, it could be very random. It could be something along the lines of what did this building used to be back in its prime, or what is it now today? Or I'm hoping if we're able to get more of kind of an engaging feedback, just random stories about these buildings and things that happened or people who were there and maybe stories from people's great-grandfathers or family that were passed down about them. That's what I'm really hoping for out of this, is just to give more of a personal experience with these structures.
As a relative newcomer to Milwaukee, and you spent some time here before and you went away and now you're back, does this also give you a connection to the community that you might not have gotten otherwise?
I definitely have to say so. I think it's hard to drive around the city and not have questions about things. And it gives me just an inside look into not only history, but where we are today and the stories that I'm able to hear and learn or read about. It makes it feel, I guess I want to say it makes it feel more like a second home to me.
How willing are people to let you go in and explore these buildings?
Well, they've actually been really, really willing. It's unbelievable. Just a random phone call saying, hey, I'm the author of this blog and I would love to take a tour of these buildings and with a photographer or with a camera. And they've always been very, very nice to go ahead and let me on in and just try to explain the history that they do know about these buildings.
Well, and let's take one of your first entries in this blog as an example. You had a chance to go and explore some parts of the Pabst complex that most people have not.
Exactly. That was one of the ones that I wasn't really expecting as much of an in-depth tour as I actually got. You know, you get in some of these buildings and they've been truly empty for decades. And you go in and the ground has caused these buildings to just shift. And you're walking on such uneven floors that you almost feel that it's not really safe. And there's times that you're going in and you're looking up at this roof and the ceiling and you're thinking, I think I should be wearing a hard hat right now. And I think that's the best part about it is that this is something that hopefully through pictures and through stories, we're able to explain things that we might not see or know from just sitting on the sidewalk, just questioning ourselves.
And where did you get to go in the Pabst complex? You actually brought a photographer along for that.
Yeah. We were able to go in through the old bottling building and we were able to go through the brew house inn and suites. And that was something that was just really neat to me because my dad, he had been coming up to Milwaukee for 35 years working for GE. And he would tell me about when he did his tour, these copper kettles were producing loads of beer. And here I am. And now it's a boutique-y hotel. And, you know, we went through the Pabst executive suites and through the old infirmary and through a couple of the other distribution centers and things like that. And it was something that, and again, it's almost a little scary, but that's what makes it fun. And we were also able to go through the old church that was there. And that's something I wasn't really expecting at all. It's been closed up for quite some time and it's beautiful on the outside, but it really draws you in as to what did it used to be during its time? And it was actually bought to be used as a conference area and also as a restaurant. And it's neat to just see, I guess, the changes in these buildings over all these decades and years.
And looking at some of the pictures, there really are parts of this complex, even as all the new construction has taken place, there are parts that really still seem frozen in time.
Oh, exactly. And something that I can't even explain enough is the old infirmary, how you go in there and some of where they would keep the medication and the records and things like that. You go in there and it's like a jailhouse. I mean, they have these giant metal doors that used to lock all of this information in. Well, whenever the buildings were closed up, everything was left open, records and all. They just shut it down and that was that. And going through these buildings, you have, I mean, you know, old letters and old notebooks and signs and just things that have been there ever since this building was probably in operation. It's just neat to be able to see.
That's funny. Have you been to the Milwaukee Public Museum?
No, I haven't.
There is an exhibit there called Streets of Old Milwaukee, which is, you know, essentially a living, breathing diorama that is a recreation of the Milwaukee of old that you can walk through. But it sounds for all the world like with a little bit of exploration, you can actually still find the streets of old Milwaukee as they were.
Exactly. I think it just kind of takes some digging around. And I'm going to go ahead and say being nosy. I think you have to ask these questions. And usually folks are so nice to be able to tell you everything that they know. And they actually appreciate the fact that today some young person off the streets has any kind of curiosity about them.
Well, and so before we wrap up, tell us a little more about the Leaning Building, where it is and what you found when you went there.
Well, the Leaning Building is on Water Street, and it's the old Weissel Building. It used to be an old it was a sausage factory. And across the street by Bar Louie was actually where the slaughterhouse was. So to think about this street now that's bustling with either cars or bar goers, I guess, on the weekends and to think about back in the day with livestock roaming, and it's just unbelievable. But it's something whenever I went into this building, you automatically feel three beers in. I mean, you are walking through this floor that is so uneven. You almost have to catch yourself at times and think, what is going on? And especially whenever you go downstairs into the basement, because then you're going down these crooked stairs. And you're having to kind of lean on the bar to make sure that you're going to get down all right. But then you go down there and the floor is so uneven. And not only that, but so is the ceiling above you. It's just, it's the most odd situation. And that's something that I guess a lot of old buildings downtown have an issue with, just being so close to the water. So it was just neat to be able to see.
In this case, tipsy is not a metaphor.
Oh, not at all. No need to intake the beer. You already filled three beers in.
So these two examples are both examples of ideas that you got just from being around Milwaukee. But if I understand correctly, you're really hoping that people bring their ideas to you with the same kind of curiosity.
Exactly. I can roam around this city and think of all these random things and think, well, what did that used to be? Or why is that like that? But what I really hope is for everyone in the city to kind of have that same question and not be shy to ask. And I would love if there's anybody who has an idea or has this building that they've been looking at and just wondering if there's a story to something, just please feel free to email me or give me a call. I'd love to know any feedback. And
they can also reach you through our own social media. We'll connect everyone here and hopefully some interesting ideas come through the pipeline.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'd love any feedback possible.
Well, Amy Robinson, thanks so much. Best of luck.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here and nice to be back in Milwaukee.
And we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds perfect. Y'all take care.
Amy Robinson is an editorial assistant at Milwaukee Magazine, and her Intersections blog appears at the magazine's website. She spoke with Mitch Tyke. We'll take one last break, and then the Master Singers of Milwaukee will present the last of their 40th anniversary concerts this weekend. We'll talk with their music director next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. The Master Singers of Milwaukee is a mixed voice ensemble made up of vocal musicians from the greater Milwaukee area. From Mahler to Monk, the choir has been entertaining area audiences for 40 years. Well, this weekend, the ensemble will perform the last of its 40th anniversary concerts at St. Paul's Church in Milwaukee. Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli is the conductor and music director of the Master Singers, and he joins me in the studio now. Eduardo, welcome back to Lake Effect. It's great to have you here.
Good morning, Bonnie. Thank you for having me again.
This concert that's coming up for the Master Singers of Milwaukee ends the 40th anniversary season, which is a long time for any group
Indeed.
Of any kind. So it's a really that's special and wonderful. It's the fourth year. It ends the fourth year of your tenure as the musical director of the group. And talk a little bit about the changes that you've seen in them in that 4 years.
Well, it has been a wonderful time that we shared together with the singers. It started in August, September of 2010, so that makes it 4 years. And I found an incredible group of human beings that are devoted to making the most beautiful music that we can possibly make together. There's a lot of incredible dedication, a lot of talent, incredible amount of talent, and a lot of experience. And so it's been a privilege for me to be working with them, sharing music with the community.
Do you find that you had to push them artistically in any way, or were they really kind of chomping at the bit to go?
Well, isn't that our job? We have to do that. We have to set the bar as high as we can, because that's when we have the most fun. And that's, of course, the challenge every day and the challenge in the future as well. How can we reach new levels? How can we do better? That's the question that we have every day, and it's a good question to have.
Do you think that the group has risen to the bars that you've
absolutely,
set?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Yes. There's more to do, like always, but yes, we have done a lot.
What would you like to see, if you could rehearse more than you can, if money were no object, that sort of thing. How would you like to push them? In what directions would you like to see them improve?
Well, it is always a challenge for a once-a-week choir. It's always a challenge to keep the pace of the learning fresh and to come to each one of the concerts to be absolutely prepared. That's the challenge for us and for anybody else as well, especially when the choir or any other ensemble meets only once a week. That is the challenge, to be as prepared as you can. But we enjoy doing it and we work hard.
Do you do section rehearsals?
We do, yes, especially at the beginning of the learning period. So the beginning of the of each one of the sections in the year, the first 2 weeks, at least say half of the rehearsal is about part learning. And it's an important time because you devote only to the section that you belong in, and we devote more time for that.
if you could, you know, thinking in terms of big picture here, what would you like to see the group do in the next 5 years? Say on their 45th anniversary season, what would you like to see them accomplish that you're working toward now?
Well, I think that probably it would be very nice to do a major piece of some sort, perhaps with a small group of instrumentalists or something like that, like a concert-long piece, like namely, say, I don't know, if I'm dreaming high, say something like St. John Passion by Bach, something like requires not huge instrumental forces in that it can be done with a relatively small vocal ensemble that we have, relatively speaking, and then with top-notch singers, particularly with a great evangelist, that will be a dream.
Well, what are you planning to do? We were talking about Bach, but you're not doing Bach on
we're
this
not,
concert.
Certainly not.
No, no. But, you know, Bach would have kind of fit in. I think he would have appreciated jazz.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, this concert is devoted only to jazz. It's the last concert of the season. And for the last several years, since I came, we devoted the last concert to more, I hate to say more fun, because we have fun with all types of music that we perform. It's just that it's more different type or different style according to the rest of the repertoire that we use during the year. But within jazz, we work hard at finding really great arrangements or really great settings, and we have a wonderful list of activities. The only thing that is not actually, technically speaking, jazz that we'll be doing for this concert is an arrangement of a piece by the Beatles. And the reason that we included that song is the Long and Winding Road, by the way, is because we are commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Beatles in the U.S. So we thought, why not including something like that in our program?
Well, and it wouldn't be the first time that the Beatles have been arranged either in jazz or bluegrass or some other way.
Absolutely.
Classical the Beatles.
Right. Yeah. The arrangement is not, technically speaking, either completely a la Beatles. It's a little bit of jazzy harmonies there. And rhythms that are flexible. So, I mean, it's granted that it's okay to have it in this program. Then we commissioned an arrangement from a great composer, young composer in Texas. His name is Joey Love. Martha Stoner, a longtime member of the ensemble, and her family, they have commissioned an arranger to write an arrangement of the Darktown Strutter's Ball, and is in honor of Martha's father, who used to play that a lot, and also he used to be a very good saxophone player. Speaking of which, we are hiring Kurt Hanrahan to play with us. He's the director of jazz studies at UWM.
So that's a nice community mix.
Absolutely.
Yeah, as well. Now, when you're working on the jazz arrangements, because it is so different from the other repertoire that you do you find that you have to work with the singers in a different way to appreciate the swing or to find their way into it in a different way?
I have to work at learning it because it is something that is, even though I have done, you know, in the past several times, it is a genre that I didn't study per se, but I love it. I love it. I enjoy doing it a lot, and I'm learning as we go. I will be completely honest. But we have wonderful people also playing with us. Our very own Jane Ladva, who is our accompanist, a regular accompanist, she is a master at probably everything. She can play any style with an amazing sensitivity and an amazing sense of style. But also we are hiring a trio, the Chris Geiser Trio, who have played with us in the past, last year and a couple of years ago in another program with jazz. And they are specialists. So they help us a lot.
They'll keep the beat going.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
I was going to ask you if you were having a small ensemble to kind of...
That will be it. It's Chris, the Chris Geiser Trio. And as I said, they bring a lot of sense of style, which we need, and also support, because we need that.
Once this 40th anniversary season wraps up, everybody takes the summer.
Yes.
What happens in the fall?
Well, we are finalizing the details for the four concerts that we'll have next season. The first one will be at the beginning of November, the very beginning of November. And the title of that concert is The Mass Mashup. So the
mashing up masses.
That will be the idea. So the idea is to have different movements from different masses, combining them and making sense out of them. So it's a really a programming. It can be a nightmare, but it can be a really creative starting point. So
are you doing the five sections of the mass? You're doing
– That will be the idea.
Okay. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Each one is from a different composer. So not only are you dealing with different genres, but different singing styles.
And also different styles, right. Different historical periods, for instance. So that's a challenge. And also managing, for instance, the overall shape, like you are creating the architecture of the piece. So you have to think about keys, for instance, you know, tonalities and styles and where they're coming from, what period. Do you really necessarily have to put an early music piece at the beginning? Does it have to be the Kyrie from the beginning? Or it can be in the end or in the middle. I have not completely decided what pieces yet, but that will be the challenge for the summer.
Well, best of luck with your ending concert for the 40th anniversary season. And I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about it just a little bit.
Thank you, Bonnie, so much.
Eduardo Garcia Novelli is the conductor and music director of the Master Singers of Milwaukee. The closing concert of their 40th anniversary season, Just Jazz 2, takes place this Saturday at 6:30 at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Milwaukee. The choir will be accompanied by the Chris Geiser Trio. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10. For Lake Effect, from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.